Sarcoma Stories is a podcast created by Sarcoma Foundation of America to highlight the voices and experiences of patients, survivors, and care partners. After listening, be sure to join our Sarcoma Stories podcast Facebook group to connect with the community and discuss the episode. Follow us and enable notifications on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform so you don't miss new episodes. You can also find all episodes and information on this subtype or your subtype on SFA's website, curesarcoma.org. Links are in this episode's description. On today's episode, we're joined by Joel and Amanda Stettler, a dynamic couple hailing from California. Joel has been knowingly living with a low-grade fibromyxoid sarcoma for the last 10 years, and in that time since his diagnosis, the Stettlers have parented three children, Amanda has pursued a doctorate degree, Joel has navigated career changes, they've traveled, and so much more. True to their motto, they have certainly lived loudly. In our conversation, Joel and Amanda share both the patient and care partner perspective on the frustrating journey to Joel's diagnosis, what life has looked like since, the honest conversations they've needed to have, and perspectives that have helped them continue living loudly along the way, even when life feels most uncertain. As a patient myself, I know the sarcoma world can feel isolating. We often look to one another, patients and care partners who understand this experience, for community, perspective, and hope. Joel and Amanda have been that for me personally, and we're so grateful they've come on the podcast to share their story with our community. A huge thank you to Joel and Amanda for joining us, and a quick shout out to their dog, who makes an early cameo in our recording, mistaking us for potential friends at the door. A true family dog keeping the Stettlers safe. Please excuse any minor interruptions. Let's dive in. Welcome to Sarcoma Stories and welcome back. If you are a regular listener, my name is Tasha. I'm one of your hosts.
Hi, and I'm Brandy. I'm your other host.
And today we are joined by Joel and Amanda Stettler. And typically I go right into, you know, saying like, Joel and Amanda, how did you come to have a sarcoma story? But I would love for you to both introduce yourselves first. I'd love for you to tell us who you are.
Hello. Thanks for having us. My name is Joel Stettler, and I have been knowingly fighting sarcoma for just about 10 years now. And so that's been a big part of how I see every day. I'm a public school teacher, husband to Amanda here, and we have three kids together. We live in California and just try to live life loud every day.
And I'm Amanda Stettler, like you said. I'm married to him and it's almost 20 years now. In addition to being a wife and mother, the COO of a company that focuses on wellness and screening services for government contracts and first responders. And then I am also a doctoral student receiving my doctorate of education in leadership and innovation.
So much going on. You two are doing it all. Thank you for the introduction. I'm like cheesing over here because I think I told Joel this the first time we spoke, but I've been following your story on Instagram for quite some time as a patient myself before we were introduced in this capacity. So I'm excited for people to get to know you because like you said, it's been about 10 years and a lot to talk about here. So Joel, how did your journey with sarcoma begin? You said knowingly fighting for 10 years. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. So I had a lump in my leg in 2010 that we got checked out. And we were told in no uncertain terms it was not cancer because we wanted to know. We asked. And they told me I had a hematoma in my leg. And they drained it for me. I felt a lot better. And since they told us what we wanted to hear, that was the answer that we went with. They did say, however, that would likely grow back the hematoma, as they sometimes do. And if in 5 years it happened again and I was uncomfortable, then come get it checked out. So 5 years later, Amanda gave birth to our youngest child. And as it happens, we met our deductible at that time. I was like, that thing in my leg grew back, I might as well get it checked out. And we had moved. So it was another doctor that was looking at my leg. And this time she was a little more concerned than the first one. And she said, I'm going to be a lot more aggressive looking into this hematoma because those things don't just happen. And sure enough, it was cancer that was causing it. It was deep in my leg. And after a slew of very tense tests and waiting periods, I was told that it was a very rare cancer. None of them had ever treated it before. And I had later been told if it had been properly diagnosed originally 5 years prior, it likely would not have passed onto my lungs, which is where they found it in subsequent scans. So that was really frustrating.
So 5 years later, when you went in and they were more aggressive in terms of looking at it, at that point, you were diagnosed with a metastasis to the lungs?
That's right. Yeah. My initial diagnosis was a stage 4.
Yeah. And I think to the point and like the different experiences between the 2010 doctor and treatment versus 2015, when he was formally diagnosed, was the original surgery that they did on his hematoma, they made probably about an inch incision. The incision the second doctor made in 2015 was about 12 inches. Only they didn't see any solid mass in the first one. It was only dead red blood cells because it was on the surface. They didn't go deep enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I thought that was a really important point to understand is being diagnosed at stage 4 with metastasis changes prognosis, it changes treatment opportunities. I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah. Well, and that was a really frustrating experience being diagnosed like that because all of the treatment options they were telling me were now off the table, surgery or amputation. They're like, that's what we do with your kind of cancer. I'm like, well, great. And they're like, but we can't do that. So that put me in the position of being in my first clinical trial. So my first rounds of chemo and everything, the whole gamut started in winter of 2016. And that's just how it's been ever since for me.
His initial oncologist at the time of diagnosis was wonderful. We had a wonderful experience. The one who guided the clinical trial. This was also a doctor who was very open to trying anything. And I think speaking from a caregiver's perspective, that was now looking back 10 years later, even I'm like, I didn't even realize how important that was, I think in the moment. But at one point, about 6 months into chemotherapy, he suggested trying a pretty radical surgical effort. Joel had significant metastases to the lungs, but the doctor was like, you actually don't need that much lung to live. And he's like, I think we could try and take a lobe out here, remove the entire other lung, and we may be able to get you cancer-free. I remember him saying, we're shooting for the moon with this surgery. So he was very clear that it was kind of a long shot, but he was going to try it. And it was a big turning point because when the surgeon did see his lungs, because up till now we had only seen scans, the way the surgeon described it to me was when Joel was in recovery, he said, I opened him up and when I felt the lungs, because they now were like compressed or they no longer were inflated, he said, I could feel like sandpaper between the tissue. And he goes, that tells me that there's just microscopic cancer everywhere. And the tumors that we're seeing are the ones that have grown. But if we were to take so much lung tissue out and try to get the big masses, it wouldn't leave you cancer-free. It would likely just eventually become more. And you would have like significant decrease in function and quality of life. So because of that, they basically just closed him up. I remember after that, it was a really hard moment because at this point they were basically like, unless something dramatically changes in treatment, he's never going to be curable. But it was also like, at least we knew we tried everything. So there was some level of being able to move forward from that space. It was just something where we're like, now we know we're on this road.
Yeah. Like this is the diagnosis and we have to work with what's in front of us.
Yeah.
This is the journey ahead. It's going to be a challenging one.
Well, exactly. And it was the thing we had been scared of and now we were there.
Yeah. Yeah. So
and what was the subtype that you were diagnosed with, just so our listeners know?
So it's a muscle sarcoma, a fibromyxoid was the subtype.
And it's low grade.
And usually that subtype is more common in young adults. And at the time, 10 years ago, you would have been definitely within that young adult category.
I had just turned 32.
When it was stage four, but when the mass appeared, like when we first noticed it, weren't you like
627?
Yeah. It's younger.
Yeah.
So right in that AYA age range. Mm.
Yeah. In all the AYA cancer circles, I've always been an elder.
And you've had the experience of aging out, which I know is a whole conversation we can get into if you'd like at some point, but that is a challenge on top of being in that category.
Right.
And so when you were confronted now with the surgery that you thought it was a long shot, but it could possibly make you cancer free and found out that's not an option, you sat down with your medical professionals and what did you guys talk about?
Well, at the time, just because of my health insurance situation, I had a doctor that I had to see and my team there was not in favor of this, which is why we had gone to people that were and more connected with research.
Can I ask you a quick question? I know I keep interrupting you, but what does a doctor you had to see mean?
So I had an HMO through my work. The attitude within that community, within the HMO, was we haven't treated this kind of cancer. And if we had, we certainly wouldn't have done it this way. So we need to stick with what we know. Right. What they did was, there's nothing to do, so we'll just make you comfortable.
They literally said that to him, to us. And I laughed out loud because I'm like, well, that's not going to be what we do. So there was a lot of battle early on to fight to get referred out to some of the specialty institutions that were offering more clinical trials and things like that. Eventually, it did lead to him changing careers and thus insurance as well.
So yeah, let's talk about that quickly. When you say it led him to change careers, how? What did you end up doing?
So at the time, and I always describe this as being like, when I talk about it, it feels like it was on another planet in a different lifetime. But I was a youth pastor. Naturally, churches have small teams for more complicated insurance situations. Mm-hmm. That was a struggle, but Amanda was a quick learner at being a squeaky wheel, and she got it done. She talked to the doctor into referring me out for research, where the attitude was very much, yeah, we don't know much about this cancer. It's under researched and there is no data on your specific type and treatment. So therefore, let's make some data. And that was just an outlook that really appealed to Amanda and me, very much so, because we just, I don't know, there's something about walking into your first post-diagnosis doctor's appointment and you walk in and the doctor's shoulders are like pre-shrugged. Like by default, he's already given up, and it didn't sit well with us. So to answer your question, cancer is complicated in religious communities.
Or it can be.
It's such a subjective experience for patients and caregivers and for onlookers. And there's an expectation in belief centered communities that a person wrestles with a crisis in a certain way. And those are usually, if they're not written down, they're sort of unspoken, agreed upon norms. And for an actual patient struggling with an actual diagnosis, things aren't so abstract anymore. And especially in an under-researched disease like a low-grade sarcoma, facts and figures and research really mattered more. So you add to that the fact that I was the youth pastor. My job was to teach young people these beliefs, and cancer was causing me to have to stare those down and really put them to the test. And what I was finding was that just like a cancer case itself, a belief system is a very personal thing. And for me to presume to teach young people what to believe or how to believe, that responsibility really gets weightier and weightier once you're thrown into a cancer fight.
And if I can even interject there, like something that is spoken to us a lot 10 years in, they're always like, you're so authentic with how you share your journey and your experiences. And like, that was what was happening in that moment. He'd be like, I don't feel authentic in what I'm teaching. And I don't want to teach or speak not in a true place. Looking back at all of this, like that time in our life, like we were not in a good place. And when I say that, I mean like grief is so nuanced, and grief doesn't just exist in the space of someone passing. Started the day he got diagnosed. And I look at like 6 month diagnosis caregiver Amanda with a 4 month old baby and two toddlers. And I'm like, why was anyone expecting anything from her? Like it's insane to me when I look back at it, because I was like, I could not process much. I had the capacity load of like nothing. It was such a hard time. And so then add to that, gosh, maybe he shouldn't be doing the work he's doing, which is currently giving him the insurance to treat. Yeah. It was just, there was a lot of turmoil. And eventually, if I can speak kind of end the story, it was, again, this doctor, thank goodness for the really, really good ones out there, because he literally said, I think you need to move and change your job. He goes, I think that would be best for your cancer right now. And we're originally from the California area, or at least I am. And we spent a lot of our early marriage here. Our support system was stronger here. And he did actually have a teaching credential in California. He had to renew it. But
I had previously been a substitute teacher. And
yeah.
That's a whole long story.
So there... It seems like this crazy thing to be like, oh my God, you just changed careers. And it really was. But at the same time, I believe that the universe aligns things when things are meant to be. And everything just, it was like, boom, boom, boom. He got a job in California and was able to resume treatment.
Yeah. I think it's the comment about the doctor actually suggesting that is interesting to me, because maybe someone who hasn't had the experience of going through a sarcoma diagnosis might hear that and be like, well, why would your doctor tell you to change jobs? Like, what do they know? And I think an important part about sarcoma care and cancer care in general is the environment you in can impact how you move through treatment. And I remember at my time of diagnosis, one of the questions they asked me immediately were, what's your support system? What do you do for work? How does that impact you on the day to day? And I was like, why are they asking me all these things? And I was like, oh, it's partially quality of life, but also informing how they know I'm supported when I'm not in their office. And so for your doctor to pose to you, hey, this actually could help your journey if you make this switch, is actually like a very important role of your oncologist to help you reflect like that.
So I, like you, I had not considered that as part of the equation at all.
Or experienced it early in the journey. But yeah, this individual definitely treated him as like a whole person, as cancer.
So in that role,
I
really didn't want cancer to be something that took me out of the job. So I worked all through chemotherapy. And after my first lung surgery, I was back in my office just a few days later. And Amanda would say, you've given 100% to this job. And we often get nothing left at the end of the night. And that was coming from a place of concern for me, because I would just be depleted at night. I'd come to my appointments stressed out of my gourd. And he was having to treat me for not just the cancer, but for anxiety and depression. And I was putting on all kinds of weight. And I was just, cancer aside, I was seriously unhealthy. And he was constantly saying, what work is doing to you? What can we do to mitigate this? And so that's what landed us ultimately in California, which is where we'd always considered home anyway. And the classroom Talk about going from abstract to concrete. California curriculum, it's black and white on paper. I go in, I teach the stuff, read the books, do the math, and it's not a single day in the classroom has gone by where I haven't been grateful for that switch.
That's amazing. Absolutely, Amanda. I agree with you when you says the universe puts us where we need to be. We may not always realize it, but I do believe that that's how things happen, and things happen for a reason. And also, it's fantastic to hear that, like you said, your doctor treated you as a person and was concerned about all of you. And to say, why is your job making you feel this way, right? We have to treat your cancer, but I have to treat you. And that's an amazing experience that someone would help you through that and give you permission. And you know, another thing that is unique in sarcoma that we don't talk about as much either is there aren't sarcoma centers all over the country. So also, while some people may hear that and think, why would you get up and move? Well, people have to do it all the time. And sometimes they can't move, so they have to be away from their families for months at a time while they're trying to get treated somewhere. While it may sound extreme for many reasons, in sarcoma, unfortunately, it's not as extreme. And that's another unfortunate part about a sarcoma diagnosis.
That's funny because we never considered it extreme to move because of medical treatment. But I mean, here we are in real time talking about relocating for not just sarcoma treatment, but a specific clinical trial. And I mean, that's the world of rare cancers.
That is a difficult decision that people in sarcoma have to make. Where can you get the treatment that you need?
On the topic of work, but I wanted to get to the clinical trials after. You moved for a job, but sometimes the reverse is happening where someone has to leave the job to move for the trial. What happens to your insurance? So it's so interesting that, you know, you talk about, oh, you know, I'm so grateful every day for this job. And I imagine it's given you this part of your life outside of cancer to help support you through your journey. But then there are people who also love their jobs and have to move around for their trials as well. So it's such a challenge going in both directions.
100%. And if I can even speak, like, in recent kind of changes, life changes, for example, he did have to switch from a in-person classroom teaching role to an online teaching role just this year. So starting in August, he had to adjust that job. And luckily he had that option. Like, we really had to kind of work hard to make that possible. And we can really actually attribute it to our community that kind of rallied around us and helped make that happen. But it exactly what you're saying in real time is, like, he didn't have to leave his job, but, like, he wouldn't have chosen to move online, like, right, if it wasn't for cancer. But that makes it possible for him to be out of, you know, the office technically and be able to go to these different hospitals or things like that.
And sarcoma clinical trials are become treatment, right? Because we have very few FDA approved therapies. And for many subtypes, there's literally nothing. How many clinical trials have you participated in?
Whoa,
that's tough.
A lot.
And enough that we have to think about it. I'd say over, like, close to double digits. Close to double digits of treatment. A few of those had just recently been FDA approved.
Well, and there's, like, clinical trials, and then there's off-label.
Off-label use, right. Yeah.
But I would definitely say the big ones was your first one.
3 phase 2 trials.
Yeah.
I'm about to start at phase 1.
Yeah. So he's moving on to his 4th, maybe 5th out of all of them. Yeah.
But yeah, like you said, not a single one targeted at sarcoma specifically.
Well, or not his subtype, at least. Right. There was a few that were, like, soft tissue tumors or soft tissue sarcoma. And then, but the one he's currently considering is just for any cancer.
When you first were approached about a trial, what was your thought process? Was it, I have no other option? Or were there hesitancies and any obstacles that you faced to participate in the trial?
Well, for me personally, I mean, Amanda's answer is probably different, but I was not well educated on clinical trials in general. I just understood I had nothing and now there's maybe something. So that's what I wanted to go for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was definitely super open about it and excited about it. I never was against it in any way, but I think you phrased it really well, saying like, we don't really have anything else. Cause I remember the doctor just point blank being like, well, it's low grade, meaning it's resistant to chemotherapy and radiation, and it's non-resectable. So those are usually our three options. So clinical trial. And we're like, well, okay. Like, I mean, really, it was like, it really was laid out that way, that there really wasn't any other option.
You know, it really molds a person's outlook on something real fast when you're told, hey, there's something inside you trying to kill you and there's nothing we can do about it. And then there's a pause and they're like, but there might be something. Like, yeah. You're all ears once they throw that in. And so I suddenly became very willing because it hit me. And I've been aware of this ever since the beginning. It hit me that all the treatments or medicines I've taken have been built on the backs of people who tried it. And so I guess it's like we're merging on the highway. You give a little, you get a little. And so to play a role in making it so fewer people behind me have to go through those tense conversations in the doctor's office, where for us, it was not just me, it was Amanda and me. And it was our three kids in there looking at that awful CT scan on the wall, being told that their dad had cancer. As many conversations like that as we can take out of the running, I feel good getting to play a part in some form of progress, even if it's just a drop in the bucket.
Yeah, go ahead. We're both wow.
I know, because that's such a profound way to say it, because it's very true how participating in these trials may not help me, but it may give us some sort of research, some sort of data, something that may move us forward and give us progress in the future. And without that, we cannot move forward and be able to collect the information that we need to and learn. Every trial that you've participated in, you've provided learning. You've provided knowledge.
We've definitely learned for ourselves as well.
Well, and I think it's interesting because, like, I work in research and am doing research myself. And I remember being told early on, no data is bad data. And I kind of laugh sometimes because we go into appointments now and he'll mention a certain trial he was on and they'll be like, oh yeah, that doesn't work at all. Like, everyone knows it didn't work. And I'm like, yeah, but like, how long would they have been going down that road before, right, if people hadn't been there to shift? So it's still good data. It was still
You're
good.
Absolutely right. We would have been going down a road and wasting time looking for something that ultimately was not going to work. So no data is bad data. At least now we know and we can pivot to something else.
Yep.
So that could potentially work.
We were just meeting with a doctor for not a second opinion, but just like another opinion on where we are, where we should go. My specialist referred us out to this doctor and she looked back at my entire history and said that clinical trial you were on came back as not working. But I believe, looking at your history, that the chemotherapy you were on in that trial is the reason you enjoyed X amount of years of stability. So it wasn't a total wash. It didn't cure my cancer, but there was a benefit. So I'd say if I had a friend newly diagnosed asking me, how should I feel about this or that trial? I'd say, ask about the possibility of something being a benefit, if not, you know, the entire treatment.
That was pretty eye-opening because, to be fully transparent, we were sitting at a crossroads of deciding if he should move back into traditional chemotherapy, which, as we noted early on, the doctor's like, that doesn't work. But traditional chemotherapy was a part of that first trial. And that's what shifted our decision with where he's at right now, because it was the first time a doctor was like, this actually might have worked a little more than we would have given it credit. But at the time, what were they crediting? They were crediting the other drug.
The immunotherapy trial.
Yeah. Right. Because they were like, oh, it seems to be behaving more stable. And now looking back, they're like, oh, well, it definitely wasn't that. So the only other variable in this scenario was the chemotherapy. So we went from pretty much together being like, no heavy dose chemotherapy anymore. It's not worth it, to being like, we'll roll the dice. We'll try it.
Oh, wow. Well, and that's the thing. You never know what's going to work. Stable disease is something.
Absolutely. Right?
If you were stage four and you lived 20 more years at stage four with a good quality of life, you have to ask yourself, is that acceptable? Right. And for a lot of people, that's acceptable. So sometimes it's, we want to find a cure, but can we make this a chronic disease? Right. How do we allow people to live longer with a good quality of life?
Yeah.
Like we early on sort of sat down and said, okay, we don't want to forget bucket lists. Let's just get out and do things. Mm-hmm. And because that's what we were seeing in the cancer community. There were no bucket lists in the cancer community. People that inspired us, the people that we wanted to be like, were people that we saw going out and doing things and living their life.
Like loudly. Every day was like lived intentionally versus being like, I'm just going to check off this one thing and then give up. And I would definitely say the stability in this disease that does appear to have been brought by multiple drugs and chemotherapy, or not chemotherapy, but clinical trials. I mean, and we have to remember in the cancer world, when we say stable, that just means that it didn't progress, what was it, 20%? So it's definitely always been progressing, but we have had to get the chance to do significantly more because of that slow progression and some level of control. And we're very, very grateful for all of the medical professionals and researchers that have made that possible.
There's a duality in the way you two talk about Joel's diagnosis of acceptance and also hope. And I'm curious how you manage those two things, accepting the reality of your diagnosis, but also we talked about the pivoting when data is showing that this isn't working, but you two are the king and queen of pivoting as well throughout this whole journey. And to do that consistently, I think you also have to have a little bit of hope. So what does that kind of mean to you both? How do you do that?
So me being like a belief-centered person, like the way I grew up was very belief-centered. And I needed to have some sort of rallying cry, some sort of banner to raise in the fight, you know? And when you're diagnosed, there's no shortage of books that get thrown your way. And my old college roommate gave me a copy of Ryan Holiday's book, The Obstacle is the Way, which was my introduction to Stoicism. And I'll always credit Ryan Holiday for getting me started on that in the fight, because in that book, I was introduced to the Stoics like Seneca, Marcus Aurelius, and so on. And Ryan Holiday talks about how it's okay to just accept things as they are, sort of it is what it is. So like I have cancer, that's one fact. So you don't say I have cancer and it's bad, because now I'm taking a fact and I'm attaching baggage to that. And this is a fight where you can't handle extra baggage. Mm. So if I take out the and it's bad, I could just look at it like it's in my hand. I have cancer. Okay, so that's the obstacle and that's the thing that's in the way. And Marcus Aurelius said, the impediment to action advances action. What stands in the way becomes the way. So this is my direction. Once you take the baggage out of something and strip it of all emotion, it becomes something that's much more possible to contend with. And once I accepted that, I looked at every other difficult thing, like the career that was wearing me down, or parenting, or financial struggle, what have you. You can look at it and take all of your feelings about it aside and just observe it. And you can pick it apart, not subjectively, but objectively, right, and find a way through it. Right. So that was like, for me, the backbone of every decision in the fight, not decisions about medical care or moving, but decisions on how I interact with whatever is being said to me, or whatever I'm reading about my case, or whatever is being pumped through my medical port.
I think what we both really took away from is that acceptance in our situation, I think a person from the outside would be like, and that's a hopeless situation, right? If you're going to accept that, it's pretty hopeless because they've very much laid that out. But something that has always been a part of our relationship was early on, we love endurance sports. Back before he had cancer, we were runners and we would do long distance running. He would do ultra marathon type events. And there's this like acceptance in that sport where like pain is going to be there. We're not trying to avoid it. Difficulty is going to be there. The point isn't to be fast. The point is simply to experience the journey, right? And I know it's a very common metaphor. I think it's why a lot of people experience things like cancer or grief or loss, like turn to distance running, but it overlays so well. And I think that's just how it became. It was like, we're not fighting this. And that doesn't lead to hopelessness. It's kind of the opposite. If we're not feeling like we're trying to fight it and we're just accepting the reality of what it is, it puts us in a very present space. And there's hope in presence because nothing's being taken from you.
Right.
Hope isn't a futuristic outlook. It's a very in the moment outlook. I have hope for the experience I get to have right now. Right. And the irony of all that journey is you mentioned acceptance and hope. And I think you have to put gratitude into that. Like it's the trifecta. And what's so funny is I tell everyone he was diagnosed basically on Thanksgiving. Like, wow. Right, voicemail left the day before. We had to talk to him the day after. It was just messy. And I, early in the grief experience of diagnosis, was so angry at illness and blessings and being thankful for what you have. And I would get really, did not like that language. And that kind of road that we just discussed experiencing and walking along with the help of really good therapists, and really good knowledge and meditation and mindfulness practices and things like that. The reality is when you learn what gratitude really is, it's that you're grateful for the present moment. Mm. And you can be grateful that that present moment is awful because you know it's not going to be there forever. You know it's going to shift. So even the very worst of things, you become hopeful and grateful for the experience because you know that something else is coming. And then when things are wonderful, we're grateful for those because we know that's not going to be there forever.
You sort of sit in those moments, grateful for the ability to do exactly that. And like, I'm scared right now. This is what it feels like to be scared. Or I'm in the chemo chair and I'm nauseous. Like, okay, this is what that feels like. And I'm glad to know it.
And it's not forever.
And you can thank your nerves or your fear or your other feelings for doing their job and informing you that you're alive.
I hope sense.
Yeah, well, it does. And it's really the entire spectrum of being alive. That's what you just said at the end there, Joel, of you can thank it for existing because it means you're alive. You're here right now. It's truly the full spectrum of being a human.
Recently, we've also had to begin the conversation of like, that also still applicable even in approaching death. Because we've had to have the pretty difficult conversations of like the doctors have given him a number. And that still has some variance, of course. But I think when early in the diagnosis, my greatest fear was what was coming, knowing that we can't stop that, but not knowing when. And if I could speak to young me or anyone that maybe is in that fearful place, I think I wish I knew that it was possible to approach conversations and realities like that with that same attitude. So this is what this feels like. This is what this phase is. And this is what we're going to experience, and not from a perspective of fighting it. It's interesting because we use the language like this is a fight, but like there is this like that acceptance and hope can exist even approaching that threshold that you would think you could never feel hope, acceptance, and gratitude in that space either. I'm not saying everyone feels that way, but I've really been shocked at the actual reality that can still exist even as we enter that space at this time.
Yeah. You know, They say for an infant, a minute or an hour can feel like an eternity because their idea of time is so unformed. And even as a child, I remember feeling like if my parents told me we were going to go to the park in an hour, that just felt like forever. And it's because kids are so good at living in the moment. They're alone with their thoughts. They pretend and they think. And that just seems to go on forever. And they lose track of time so easily. But as adults with responsibilities, we sort of give up that ability. And we don't live in the moment. We live in the next moments or the next hours or days or weeks. And so to do what Amanda's saying and just sit in the moment and point out not just what's going on, like I'm scared right now, this is how this feels, but also, and here's how I'm still going to be Joel in the face of that. And you don't lose yourself. If you find yourself in those moments, you realize you are living in the moment. And that moment is so much more valuable time than just spent being scared or angry or otherwise preoccupied with the disease.
Yeah, I do think that is a really important thing that you just said, because that is it's a scary conversation. And I think it's maybe something we all think of. I know that was one of my first thoughts when I was diagnosed, of when and how long. And for my caregivers, I can't imagine what they were feeling at that time too. But I think it gives permission for people to be scared. And like, we are all so scared of that. And that's why we don't often talk about it. Like, we haven't had anyone on our podcast up until right now say that out loud, of like, that we have had to have that conversation, and it's a scary thing to do. And we're doing it. And with everything else you talked about, with hope and gratitude and presence, is it gives people permission to say, this is scary and let's talk about it, so we can have those moments in the present now. I think that's incredibly important. And something else you said, Joel, was it allows us to be Joel and Amanda. And that's why I wanted to start with who is Joel and Amanda, because you are more than this diagnosis. Even though it's such a huge part of your lives and has been for the last 10 years, it's not the only thing about Joel and Amanda. And as you're talking, you both have a relationship where you are such a team with this diagnosis, but a team as Joel and Amanda too. And I think just what you're saying about speaking how scary it is, except like, this is what it is, let's look at it. It allows you to be Joel and Amanda, the couple, Joel and Amanda, the individuals, and be so present to that. And I think that's so beautiful and so freeing for a lot of people who are finding themselves in that position with you.
Yeah. And I mean, to be honest, the biggest thing I think we've taken away just this year, at least for me, is like what an honor it is to get to occupy that same space with someone. Mm. And like, we've been through so much, but this last year has probably been the hardest medically in a long time. And he's definitely had a lot of deterioration and a lot of symptoms and a lot of progression and a lot of surgeries. And through all that, as a team, as a couple, as two people who just love each other beyond this universe, it really is the honor of a lifetime get to share those difficult conversations and that path with someone. And so again, this idea of at this point in time, fighting that or pushing that away, I'm just so thankful to be in a spot to be able to recognize that, because I think that's the biggest thing, is there's just a depth that has come out of this. And I'm never going to say I'm thankful for cancer. Like, right. No, like it shouldn't exist and it shouldn't be in anyone's life. But I do think it's a wonderful reminder that I'm not a positive person. I describe myself very much as a realist. I plan for the worst and maybe get a little bit of the best, but
that's really what's come out of it, is I think that I'm just suddenly, instead, every horrible thing has given something that we've been able to make good of.
Well, and I attribute it, if Amanda and Joel look like a team at all, I'd attribute that to early on, we had, and ongoing, we've had discussions about what it is going to take for each of us to be able to keep moving forward and to progress as an individual. And I mean, that goes for both of us, because a lot of times she'll get down and say, I'm sorry, I shouldn't be complaining. You're the one with cancer. I'm like, but it's happening to you too. Mm-hmm. And when she owns that, that frees her up to be able to say, okay, well then in that case, here's what I could use from you. And with her, it's usually something about communication or whatever. I can't remember. with me early on, it was like, Amanda, as much as you care to be with me in appointments, that would be super helpful. And I think it's important, if you're in any kind of a partnership after a diagnosis, to have those conversations about, like, how are each of us going to continue to thrive as human beings, even among the cancer?
That's so important, because this is the part of the diagnosis and the patient and the care partner / spouse experience that it matters a lot. And I think you do have to have those conversations. And it's another conversation that can be really difficult. And I think you sharing your experience with it gives people permission to have those. And that will only strengthen, I think, the support for both of you.
You guys know all cancer cases are totally unique, as are relationships.
Yep.
Right.
And so your post-diagnosis partnership can be what all parties decide they are.
Yeah, you have agency.
I've heard a spouse that's a care partner say, sometimes you get so caught up in being the care partner, you forget that you're also the spouse. Amanda, I guess that's kind of a question for you, is how do you balance being a wife and a care partner?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I don't know if my answer is unique to us or could be potentially relatable. But I will say that I think the way he was diagnosed definitely set a trajectory for the way we were able to really maintain what you're saying, like being both spouse and caregiver. And I think it's because right off the bat, quality of life was always 100% a priority. And part of it was because we didn't have much choice, right? It wasn't like, well, we can cure you. It was always, you're going to have to live with this. So all of our decisions early on were always revolved around, how are we going to live the best quality of life possible? And immediately, number one on that was, we have to like still have our relationship as a couple. And we had really young kids, but again, we kind of moved heaven and earth within a year and a half of his diagnosis to go to Thailand, just the two of us, right? We literally changed our entire budget so that we lived on one income, so that the second income 100% was directed at this. And that's because literally in the hospital, we sat in the chemo room and looked at a map and said, okay, what is as far opposite of this chemo room that we could get, right?
And still be on land.
And still be on land a little bit. But yeah, basically the opposite, which was Thailand. But that in and of its decision-making was because this is going to be a time for us to be partners and spouses and prioritize that. And that almost set a tone. Travel has become really important as a family, and we've been able to do that with our kids. But again, in reference to Joel's, we don't have a bucket list. We just say yes to literally everything that we possibly can. But it gave us opportunities to have these times away where we got to be a couple. Because that's one thing I think, is that being away from the city where you're seeing doctors and the medication pharmacy pickups and things gives you this moment of, we're just a couple. Mm-hmm. And so that definitely, I think, was part of it. And that bleeds into every other part of life. Like when you start to have those experiences and they're so meaningful, you're like, well, I want to have this feeling when I'm at home cooking dinner and when we go out on dates. And so I definitely feel like that has 100% never wavered in the caregiving / spouse role.
Speaking of your young kids, how have you brought your kids into this journey that you've been on for 10 years? And what are the challenges that you have faced with that, if any?
Right after diagnosis, we protected them quite a bit. We would make sure they're not in doctor's appointments, things like that. They were young enough to almost not, most of them don't have memories of Joel before cancer. So it's always been this constant kind of in the background. And so because of that, it's definitely allowed us to have age-appropriate conversations regularly. Like it was never anything we hid or shied away from. But I remember for a very long time being very protective that they didn't see cancer as a terminal discussion. And I remember when they reached the age that that began to come up. And so we didn't shy away from it. That's when we talked about it. And while they vary in ages, so each of them have a little different knowledge, we've also made cancer, like, should I say fun?
Yeah, you know, it's sort of...
Yeah.
Living alongside it with them.
Yeah. So like, for example, during COVID, we would travel to another city for treatment and stay in hotels. And they recognized very quickly that cancer trips meant DoorDash. And they loved that. And we always brought a board game and we'd get a new board game for it. Or we'd go to the bookstore and we'd get books.
Yeah. We always went to Barnes and Noble on the way to the cancer trip. And they loved
that.
They would
all get a book. And then we do silly things like IKEA, and they love freaking IKEA. And again, as they age, those trips have changed to some degree and like what we choose to do, but we never do something cancer related without doing something fun. And because of that, I definitely would like to venture and say that it's softened all of the awfulness that it comes with it. And they've also, we've always done it together. So they know we're not going to be gone for cancer stuff. We're going to be there together. And they get to be with their dad, even when he feels sick. It's really a beautiful experience, I think, that I can say, hopefully as adults, that they recognize that. And it's also made it much easier for when they have had questions or wanted to have and share difficult emotions. It really has been easy to enter into those. It's never felt like they didn't have words for it, or we didn't have a space where they could come to us. So I've been proud of that, and I hope we can continue that as we move forward.
You mentioned early on in this discussion, we think about grief after the fact, but we don't talk about grief throughout the process. Can you talk about that for others who may be experiencing it and not even realizing it and not even putting words to it like you have?
Well, I very much credit the acknowledgement of the grief process as something that has allowed me to heal in real time, despite him still having cancer, right? So I personally went to therapy pretty early on in the experience to talk therapy. And that was something that my therapist is who made me aware of that. And the minute I started to see anger as grief, not as why am I such an angry person now and almost belittling myself for it or being ashamed of it or hiding it, it was healing. And so cancer is heavy enough as it is to then have all this unresolved anger and depression and bargaining and denial happening and going not acknowledged. So again, I think I see waves of grief still very present and it'll escalate at times, but naming something, we talked about fear, naming something makes it so much less frightening and it gives that permission and that space to be like, okay, this is where I am now. And that is also gonna shift. And so I very much credit my therapist for naming that. It didn't necessarily eliminate grief. It doesn't change it necessarily, but it feels significantly less heavier, the emotions that you're experiencing in it, because I can acknowledge it as grief.
Well, there's just a constant need to grieve with cancer because every day there's something, it seems like there's something new to lose.
Yeah.
And there's so many things in life that you try to do to add value to the experience and add value to yourself and to each day. I've lost running. I probably run my last marathon. Probably never going to ski or snowboard again or surf. And it just got started on that. And like all these things that I wanted to do to add value to my life and to who I am and the overall experience of being Joel. And I don't get that anymore. And most recently, I've lost the classroom. And I had a lot of pride in telling people I taught third grade. And with that, though, there's so many experiences where because of the cancer, I'm told who I am to people. And they tell me, you know, something I said or something I wrote that mattered to them. Or they tell me something meaningful about my kids or something they saw my wife do that was so cool. And I'm realizing I've gotten to see my own funeral, like, you know, all the people trickling in and they don't know it, but they're paying their respects in a way when they do those things. And what a gift to live that out in real time. And so while I've lost all those things, the prize is still there somehow. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand it, but there's just a gift in the grieving process of, okay, so I've skied my last run and this is what that feels like. And yet every day there's somebody that says something that puts wind at my back. And that's something, and that has value. You take the grief process with a grain of salt and you accept what you can't change and hang on white knuckled to what you can.
I really appreciate that response of someone living with a sarcoma diagnosis. I've heard before the saying, like, the only time all of your people gather for you is your wedding and your funeral. And I have always thought, well, then how lucky am I to have experienced a cancer diagnosis where I've also had the experience of everyone gathering for me in my lifetime. And, the way you just described that honestly makes me a bit emotional because it is something to gain. We don't all go through life and then have our funeral knowing how people feel and think about us. And so to experience that is a gift in a way that I wouldn't wish on anyone, but feel very, I guess, lucky to have in a way. So I've never heard someone actually put that into words like you have. And that's really special.
Yeah. And it's one that, like, I don't think it's a gift I deserve as a person. It's sort of like I got a, you know, even in the midst of the ugliness, I got like a cheat code and can just kind of see people's thoughts. And I'm grateful for the people that have shared and reached out. And I try to do the same knowing that when someone's talking to me and, oh man, what you, I'm hearing this and wow, thank you for that. And because I don't know, it's such an easy gift to give somebody. Like, why not?
It's all these gifts that, no, you don't need a cancer diagnosis to learn, but it does really highlight it. And partially why I enjoy having these conversations is because if somebody else can take away something from it and not have to experience cancer to go about life, being generous with their words to others and being kind and living presently without the imminent diagnosis on them, I hope people take that away. I've always felt that about my own diagnosis, but I do hope that it's a gift I can give others through what I've experienced because it has given me that presence too, like you talked about. So I don't know if you feel similarly, but.
Definitely.
Now, Joel, I also know that you are a stand-up comedian. How does your love for laughter and comedy and being funny, how does that play a role in your journey?
Well, I tell you what, when you go to a comedy club and get on stage and reveal that you're going to joke about cancer, the room gets real quiet. But struggle is universal and it's also absurd and absurdity is funny. So in one of my bits, I say, what am I going to do? Just sit in my predicament languishing? I'd rather make it weird for everybody. The feedback I get after a show is twofold. One, everyone wants to talk about their cancer story because there's not a single person unaffected my cancer, yeah. but two, people recognize their own feelings in a joke. Like that's why we laugh. And we don't usually laugh when we're alone, or when we do, it feels weird because laughter is a social cue where we show everyone around us that we hear it and we understand and see the absurdity. So point out the absurdity, like in a cancer experience, first of all, is really easy because cancer is ridiculous and it's low hanging fruit. Okay. So for me, it's a coping mechanism, but what I didn't expect was that it's been a massive connection tool with other people.
And I will say, a terminal cancer diagnosis also gives you a lot of like, why not, you know? And like, before he ever was diagnosed, he was like, I feel like I would be a good stand-up comedian. And I'm like, what? Like, what? And he's like, I've always thought I'd be good at that. So like the fact that he's like, I'm just going to do it, like that is very much came out of cancer, right? Because I think we're so afraid to put ourselves out there or how people will see us. And when you don't really have a lot of time left on a clock, you're very much like, why not? So that's something that absolutely contributed, I think, to that path now. Yep.
Joel, where do things stand now for you in your journey?
Okay, so I feel like I should point out the elephant in the room, and that's I'm not so great at talking without coughing anymore. My voice is just so totally different, and it's not from overuse. My lungs just, like, the best way to describe it is they feel angry all the time, and the need to cough is always there, and it's never productive. They're just inflamed.
And this is from the metastases, and he's had significant pleural effusions in the last year to the point of inserting catheters so he could have fluid drainage. So there's just been so much done to his lungs that even just from last year, this time to now, symptoms are definitely having progressed.
Yeah. And my palliative care team obviously is trying to figure out a way to mitigate that and manage the coughing.
But it is a reality.
But mm-hmm. I mean, what a blessing that I'm able to do online school. I meet students one-on-one. They all know the situation I'm in. So they're very patient and gracious with me. But when I meet with my students, they don't care. I mean, they care. They're nice. But it's no sweat with the coughing. Whereas in a classroom full of kids, it was very tough to raise my voice to a level where everyone can hear me. And mm-hmm. trying to teach basic math concepts through a coughing jag, it was time to move on. So I'm in a position where work-wise, it's not so bad, but just functioning as a member of society, I have to change the way I do stand-up comedy.
I do feel like I remember at one point where thinking of cancer to a degree of like disability. And I remember thinking, well, but like it really, other than chemo and things, it doesn't affect him. Now we're seeing like the limitations that the disease is putting on his ability to walk certain distances or climb stairs.
And I mean, just day-to-day stuff you wouldn't even think about, but like maybe I left my water bottle upstairs and it's time to leave. I guess I'm not drinking water today because I'm not going up there.
I can to manage it.
Yeah.
We've covered so much, and I want to open it up before we go to a message you want to leave with listeners.
Is it all right if I do a quick plug?
Absolutely.
Say whatever you want.
Because I feel like I feel like our producer friend would be really sad if we forgot to mention there's a documentary being made about our family. So if any of this conversation was intriguing, you can go to joelfromfresno.com, get a bit more of the story.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Ben because we wouldn't have met and had this conversation if we didn't shout out Ben.
No, I forgot about that.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that I would tell caregivers, if I was going to leave a message to the spouses or the caregivers, is I always say, I don't want to get sad. I'm the sad one. But I always used to tell people it's going to get a little easier. Like I remember that first, second, third day of diagnosis thinking,
how can we do this? And like every day got a little better. And I remember even in that mid kind of point of where we had been riding this wave for a while and it wasn't horrible, but it wasn't great, thinking, well, but it's gonna get worse. And I think I would still stand by the message that first day is the worst. And so if there's hope for any caregiver, as the days go by, I wish someone could have told me that like it's gonna get not necessarily lighter, but it's gonna be easier to manage as time progresses. And I think in the cancer world, that just can go really far, you know, when it's hard.
I'd say the same for the patient, because it's a lot like parenting. We felt so ill-equipped with our first child and wondering, how does a person mentally, emotionally, and physically parent? And I'd say to a new parent, a new patient, a new caregiver, like, you would be so surprised at what you're capable of.
Mm. So true. Yeah. Absolutely. I'm sure there are people listening who want to follow along on your journey. So where can listeners find you both?
So we are both most active on Instagram. Hey, Mr. Stettler, with the dreaded underscores in between.
Same with me, but I'm Rhythm and Light.
Amanda, I think you are Rhythm and Light, like as a human being. That's a very appropriate Instagram handle for you. Yeah.
Well, it comes from a cool story. You can edit this out if you don't want it. But the marathoner, Eliud Kipchoge, he's an amazing runner. His coach gave him that mantra. He said, this is what you're going to say in a marathon, rhythm and light, rhythm and light, rhythm and light. And I was like, that's brilliant. So I've really embodied it. Yes.
I actually love that story and I want to keep it in because like you said earlier, that there are a lot of parallels with running and cancer and the world's kind of go well. Rhythm and light, that sounds like a mantra that you've lived in the last 10 years.
But on purpose. She's very purposeful about that.
Yeah.
Very intentional people. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It is a joy to talk to you. So thank you so much for joining us, for setting aside time to speak with us and to share. It really was such a gift to have this conversation with you.
Definitely.
No.
SFA created Sarcoma Stories to highlight the individual stories of sarcoma patients, survivors, and care partners. To amplify the many stories we consistently hear and bring together the broad range of lived experiences of sarcoma patients, SFA has also created a Sarcoma Journey Survey. This survey is vitally important as we need to collect data for sarcoma subtypes to help advance research and effective treatments and put data to the stories we consistently hear. To learn more about this survey and to take the survey yourself, please head to the show notes and you'll find the survey link.
Thanks for joining us today. Did this episode resonate with you? You can join the discussion about this episode in our Sarcoma Stories Facebook group, linked in the show notes. If you found this podcast helpful, your feedback is incredibly valuable and helps to create more awareness about sarcoma while sharing vital resources with someone who may need it. Be sure to leave a rating and review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.